On the 50th anniversary of American track and field icon Steve Prefontaine's tragic death comes the new book, The Frontrunner, a reappraisal of his life and legacy, a powerful work of narrative history exploring the forces and psychology that made him great and separating the man from the myths. On the anniversary of his untimely death, author Brendan O'Meara, host of the Creative Nonfiction Podcast, offers a definitive retelling of Prefontaine's life, revisiting one of the most enigmatic figures in American sports with a 21st century lens. Brendan is the founder and host of the Creative Nonfiction Podcast. As a sports writer, he's covered a wide swath of events, including the Kentucky Derby, the Preakness Stakes, and the Belmont, as well as several local and professional sports for Trail Runner magazine, Bleacher Report, and the Associated Press. The new book, The Frontrunner, The Life of Steve Prefontaine, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Brendan O'Meara back to the roundtable. It's been a long time. Thank you very much.
It has. My gosh, the last time we had a book conversation, it was 2011 for 6 weeks in Saratoga. I mean, we were just kids, Joe.
Yeah, I know. It's isn't it fun to count the years?
I know.
Well, I'm delighted you're here. I'm delighted that you have the new book out. It's fascinating. What brought you to this particular subject? Because it's very specific, obviously, and I'm just interested in what your awareness was of Steve Prefontaine prior to taking on a project like this.
Yeah, my prior knowledge of him came from just growing up an athlete. You just learn of these very iconic, charismatic athletes, these megafauna in these sports. But I was really steeped in him when I was working in some specialty running stores. I worked for a Fleet Feet in Washington, D.C., and one right there in Albany on Wolf Road for a couple of years. And on a busy Saturday, we might have, without limits, one of the biopic films just running all day long, the Billy Crudup one, the superior of the two. And that would just be there. And you would just, you steeped in him like a warm bath. Like, wow, what is this? What is this guy? Who is this guy? And I've since moved out to Oregon, and I live in Eugene, where he really made a name for himself. And you're really talking about being steeped in the lore. You know, he is as big a statue as there is out here. And it was a few years ago when we were really starting to interrogate a lot of the statues that were standing up in this country. And I was like, I think, you know, Prefontaine, a few years from now is going to be the 50th anniversary of his death. And that's always a great hook if you're writing a long magazine feature or a biography in this case. And I was like, well, I think it might be time to do that reappraisal in that modern lens, because he was built for the modern day. He was built for Instagram, and he just made for a great topic to investigate.
There were two words that I used in the introduction that I think are interesting. One is myth, and the other one is enigmatic. So what were those qualities in him that made him interesting then, makes him interesting now?
Yeah, the mythology is the thing that we've been fed for decades about this very roguish James Dean-ish figure in American track and field, of which he was. He had this middle distance runner who all he did was run in circles, and yet he still captivated the country and certainly the track and field scene. And this was always going to be a project of restoring his humanity as best I could. There's this great quote from Kitty Kelly, who was in turn quoting JFK, and this was one of my North Star guiding principles when I was writing the book and researching. She said, to quote JFK, "The great enemy of the truth is very often not the lie, deliberate, contrived, and dishonest, but the myth, persistent, persuasive, and unrealistic." So this project was always such a character study to get to the man behind the myth, this legend that we have seen of this roguish figure, and try to remind people and restore the sense of boyhood and young manhood and friendship and boyfriend and teammate, and ground him in his humanity so we can relate to this very sort of kind and really brilliant figure who was just pushing up against the power structures of the day. And he was just an inspiring figure, and enigmatic in a part because he died young, we're left with not much of a track record, but my goodness, he did pack a lot into 24 years. And at a 50-year remove, we have such a great perspective of what made him so special.
And that's an aspect that I wanted to ask you about. I mean, he died at 24 years old, so young, but accomplished so much and is enough for you to really dig in and write about a fascinating career that he did a lot in those 24 years.
Exactly. He was so aware that he was a draw and that people came to see him. And he was always made for such great copy, which made him really fun to research because the newspaper archives are awash in amazing stories, of which he gives some of the most colorful quotes you would ever see and read. And he has a preternatural ability to connect with his fans. Even as a young man and 18, 19 years old, he'd be writing these dispatches back to his hometown newspaper in Coos Bay, The World, to update people about what he was doing in Europe. And having these connections and forging a relationship is very much what we see modern athletes do today with their Instagram accounts and really connecting with their fans and trying to create a certain measure of authenticity and transparency to what they're doing out in the world. And we might call that brand building today, what a lot of athletes are very conscientious of. Not that that was a thing back then, but he was very aware of his image and used the media to leverage them to create that greater connection. And so we have such a wonderful portrait of a young man, really at the height of his powers by the time he passed away.
Brendan O'Meara is our guest. The name of the new book is The Front Runner, The Wife of Steve Prefontaine. You talk about brand. So 2 years after the Nike brand was born, Steve signs up to be their spokesperson, and this is obviously this was big for them. It was big for him.
It was so critical. Like at that time in the amateur code, like athletes could not be professional without ruining their amateur status and thus being unable to compete in the Olympics. Something that's totally foreign to us now, and so he couldn't be an official sponsored athlete for the young upstart running company. But they, through a really clever loophole, they basically give him this job that extricated himself from having to have the day jobs of the time, be it a teacher or a lawyer or whatever, that often took away so much of the bulk of these amateur athletes' training times. Because by the time they get spit out of college, they lose the institutional support they had grown familiar with. And then they had to have a job. They were starting families. So a lot of these men now spit out at 22 or 23, and maybe they're teachers and they're training in the morning, going to work all day and then training at night and trying to put out the best American track and field team as possible when all of their attention couldn't be focused on it. So yeah, Steve hooking up with Nike in the way he was able to, it was an alignment of values and a rebellious spirit, but they realized they didn't want him wasting his time not running and not training. So he would give these clinics and motivational talks to local high schools, sitting in the grass and telling them about race tactics and mental preparation. But these were things that allowed him to not have to waste his time, and he could train and he could really focus his energies towards the 1976 Olympics, of which he was not able to compete in.
At 15 years old, he's in Marshfield High School, and he sets his first national record. And that really sets up the first flag, doesn't it, that this kid is special?
Yeah. In 1969, as he's a senior, he's pushing, he's going to break the national two-mile record in like 8:41.5, I believe. And, that in that moment, which is really cool, I was able to give his high school coaches real estate that they typically hadn't had in the past. Bill Bowerman and Bill Dellinger of the University of Oregon often get the lion's share of Pre's development, but it was really nice to give those coaches who had such an eye for Steve's development. And Coach McLaurin, talking to Phil Persian, he would say, like, after he broke that record, what we will have failed this boy if he peaked in high school. They really worried that maybe they trained him too or pushed him too hard, and he peaked in high school like so many athletes do. They peak young and then they flame out. But yes, that breaking that record, it put him in track and field news and headlines. They put him on the national scene, and he's getting bombarded with scholarship offers. But there was really never any question. University of Oregon, this temple of middle distance runners, they were the front runner to secure Steve's talents.
And I find that interesting because it's also his home, right? I mean, it's near. It's in Oregon, and it's his home state, and that's where he lands.
Exactly. There, he was such a homebody for the state of Oregon. You know, around the time of his passing, he had a cousin who asked him, like, you know, why don't you leave? Why don't you branch out a little more and get out of Oregon? He's like, I can't leave my people. And he had that real connection to Oregon and wanting to showcase his state to track athletes who would come into town, the foreign athletes that he brought in from Finland in this series of meets in the Pacific Northwest in sheer defiance of the AAU at the time. And he was so proud of the Pacific Northwest and specifically Ireland, Oregon. And the connection to the place is so integral to his character. And Oregon in and of itself becomes a great canvas to lay his story on.
Given his ascendance and given even what we were talking about when we mentioned Nike, what's also fascinating is this was a time when this was a sport that wasn't really part of the mainstream yet.
No, it really wasn't. It was before it was professionalized, but the waters were really brackish between the old world amateurism and what would soon become the professional track that we know. There was this upstart International Track Association that was emerging after the 1972 Olympics to try to get these guys paid. And yeah, as a result of some of that, Sports Illustrated was covering it back in the day, Steve makes the cover of Sports Illustrated at the age of 19 at the U of O. And it is, even though track wasn't super mainstream, Prefontaine managed to, he muscled himself into the mainstream just based on the way he talked, the way he looked, and the way he ran. He was a captivating figure that brought track, into the zeitgeist in a way that has been hard to reclaim.
When he is going to school and he's at Oregon, what was it always going to be the Olympics? I mean, that's where he was going to head.
That's the gold standard. Then as it is now, but even back then, it was all there was. It's all he thought about, really. The way he thought about it, going back to his high school days, and even his mother said he was crazy for thinking that he could be an Olympian. But he had such belief in himself, and his talent matched his belief, and he was, my gosh, talk about the stars aligning. I mean, here he is. He's going to be 21 in the Olympic year. The Olympic trials are hosted at Hayward Field at the University of Oregon. Bill Bowerman's going to be named the track and field coach for the United States, his college coach. If ever there were the perfect Olympics for him to come onto the stage and really make a name, it was going to be these 72 games. They were always there. And then once he metabolized the 72 Olympics and put that in the rear view as best he could. Yeah. And then it was all about the 76 games too. It's all he thought about.
Which brings up two questions. One, what do you think happened in Munich? He finished fourth in the 5,000 meter. What do you think happened?
Yeah, there's the racing aspect of it where he lamented beforehand when he was handicapping the race. I forget the exact 2 mile split, but he figured if it was going too slow, it would be detrimental to him, and he would have to just take it to the lead and do his best he could if he found it going too slow. And it was going very slow, and he failed to maybe assert himself in a way that there's no way he sits on his haunches at Hayward Field in Eugene. If he sensed that pace going that slow, he would have just taken it to the front and said, come and get me. And then, tactically in that final mile, when he strikes the lead and he's leading for most of the final portion of that race, on the backstretch of the final lap, he attacks Mohamed Gamoudi and he gets blocked and his momentum is stalled. And had he just stopped there, good chance he hangs on for the bronze medal. But he knew no other way than to run hard and to run to win. So he attacks again, gets blocked again, and that pretty much gassed him. And he almost falls over at the end as he's clipped by Ian Stewart and loses the bronze medal as a result. But there's also the attacks that happened with the on the Israeli team,
right?
And that really got in his head. He didn't want to race. He gave voice to that in an article after the Olympics sometime. He's telling the reporter, he's like, that Israeli thing, that took me a year to get over, a whole year. And when he was on the starting line in another story, he was just like, I'm done. I don't want to race. And for Steve Prefontaine to say, like, I don't want to race, he's a sensitive guy, but for him to be on the starting line of the biggest race on the biggest stage of his life, the only thing he ever thought of, and the fact that he would have said, if you put him on a plane to go home and not race, he would have done it. That's not the best headspace to be running against the best 5,000 meter runners in the world. So throw that into the recipe too, and there's no doubt that it probably affected how he performed.
Life was cut short by a car accident, as we mentioned, at the age of 24. He was coming back from an awards banquet in Oregon. What do we know of what happened?
It's really murky, but the research that I was able to research in reporting I was able to do, there was either, he took evasive action either from another car approaching him, or he just lost sight of the road and he, cut his wheel to the left and he smashed into this rock and it flipped his 1973 MGB and it, landed on top of him, and it would eventually, he's probably alive for upwards of 60 to 90 seconds as the car just lay on his chest and, squeezed the life out of him. He wasn't inebriated at the time. He had been, at this banquet you mentioned, and he was at a party at another house, and he was driving a friend back to Kenny Moore's house up on Judkins Point Hill on Skyline Boulevard, just off Skyline here in Eugene. And there might have been another car involved that caused him to swerve. And it's just one of those things where I feel like there was another car involved. That's kind of the conclusion I draw. We're probably never going to know, but the fact is the circumstances under which he died for so long really overshadowed the way he lived. And so in doing this book, I'd like to think that maybe his life has started to overshadow the way he died.
We will never know those details. We'll also never know if he would have won a medal at the 76 Olympics.
Exactly. He was really coming into himself, really at the height of his powers, I think, as an activist, athlete activist, as an athlete. He was 5 seconds shy of breaking Ron Clark's 6 mile world record in a meet. He wasn't even trying to break that record. And it just gives you an idea of how good he was feeling and just the extent to which he was developing in a way that a lot of other athletes weren't able to back in the day, because he didn't have to split his time, maybe taking a different job. And so he's organizing these meets and bringing people over and really starting to platform other athletes too, not just himself. And you have to play hypotheticals to how he would have done in Montreal in 76. But I think he would have done something pretty special.
So as you look at the anniversary, what do you think the legacy is?
Yeah, it's, thanks in part to Nike keeping his flame alive and the meet here in town, the Prefontaine Classic, which just celebrated its 50th renewal, and, having movies made about him. He is very much this, his legacy really is. And I came to realize, really running your own race, your internal race, not selling yourself short. A lot of us, I think, we waste a lot of time. And I feel like I've wasted 24 years of my own life. And he packed so much life into 24 years. And I think a great lesson from his life, the way he lived, was, you might not be a world champion runner, but you can certainly be the best version of yourself, racing different versions of yourself. And so that belief, I think that's what makes us connect to him, because if we can harness a little bit of that flame, there's no doubt that a lot of us can achieve, so much more and not pass by complacently.
The name of the book, The Front Runner, The Life of Steve Prefontaine, It is a fascinating look at a fascinating individual. The book is published by Mariner. Brendan O'Meara, I thank you very much for being with us. It's a great pleasure to have you back on the show.
What a joy to be back. Hopefully it won't be 14 more years before we talk again.
I look forward to our next go-around, and congratulations on the new book. Be well. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.